multiple years, and eventually you get spongy deterioration from all the misfolded proteins. Let me drop. Well, medical science really likes to experiment, and so they wanted their own prions, and they worked very hard. They found some prions that work for rats, which is great if you're a rat and you want to cure rat diseases, but not terribly good for human beings. So they actually went to the trouble of they took some proteins that are common in human nerve cells, and they coaxed it into deforming into a prion. And they planted it on all kinds of things, and it seems to take. So we've recreated a terrible disease that that causes early senility, if you will. That's the symptom of mad cow disease in human beings. And they hope that once they could create it, they could figure a cure for it. So I hope they do, because, you know, mad cows need some help, and some mad people need some help. Let me drop. Okay, here's another one. There was a study about Jupiter lightning. Let's see. They had Juno orbiter that I think was launched in 2016, and recently they've been reporting on the lightning in Jupiter, and apparently they've decided that lightning in Jupiter is kind of very, very similar to the lightning on Earth. So, you know, Jupiter has nothing on us. So, although, if you remember from previous conversations on this TechNet, we don't know a heck of a lot about Earth lightning either. So, I guess the same goes for Jupiter lightning.
A comment?
Next on the roster is, I think we talked about this some time ago, but it got back into the news. A bunch of guys at the National Academy of Sciences reported the other day that they had developed a new simplified model for planetary motion in order to figure out what they think was the starting rotation of the Earth 1.4 billion years ago, and they came up with pretty much the same number that they had before. Approximately 19 hours was a day 1.4 billion years ago, and you could thank the moon for that. When the moon started out, they theorized that it was only 44,000 kilometers away. It's now gotten to 384,000 kilometers, and apparently, roughly, it slows the Earth's rotation 174,000th of a second each year. So it's going to keep on making us have longer hours in a day until the tidal lock occurs on the moon, and then it'll just be facing one part of the Earth forever and ever and ever until something terrible happens to knock everything out of whack.
Comet on Jupiter lightning?
Sure.
I was wondering, this is WA2, Victor David Henry. I was wondering if the Jupiter lightning, I think I saw that article, but I didn't get a chance to read all of it. Was the lightning occurring at the borders of different moving cloud tops where those bands were showing the banding on Jupiter? Was the lightning occurring at the junction of different bands, or was it within one band, indicating that maybe was the cross turbulence that was generating it? Go ahead.
Well, like most things, at the end of this technical net, I will be offering a series of linkable articles to everything at roy.ac2gs.com. According to what I read, they found that most of the lightning was occurring at the poles, more often the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere, but I don't recall them discussing banding as a phenomenon.
I see. Okay, thanks.
Okay, on to the next. It goes over to Paul's SpaceNet report, but maybe Paul would like to discuss it as well. Curiosity results were published recently, and NASA presented some interesting findings that there were fluctuations they found on the methane discharge on Mars, and that there were organic compounds that were detected by the apparatus that was landed there. Now, it depends on who you read. Some are more sensationalist than others. Some guys out there started to yell that there's life on Mars, or that there was life on Mars. All that this really shows is that if there was ever life on Mars and there wasn't proper life for it to eat, it might survive by digesting the organic high chemical energy bonds in these molecules. So put down as a very possible maybe, not a definite. And if methane made that much of a difference, recently they've done a report on Pluto. Pluto apparently has dunes filled with methane. So no one's talking about anything living on Pluto, last I heard.
WS2N.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, NASA says that they're going to have a news conference, which they did, and social media jumps all over it, and this has happened many, many times, that the different social media platforms will start telling you that they're going to make an announcement that they found life on Mars, and the first thing that Michelle Fowler, she was the moderator. She's a, in fact, I've seen her on many, many documentaries. She's an astronomer, but she works for NASA over at Ghana. And then she said, first thing I want to tell you is that, you know, because of the social media stories, that we did not find life on Mars. So then they went through their whole news conference and questions and answers and the whole one-hour story on that whole deal. So, you know, by the way, they came right out and told people, this is not what we're doing. You know, don't get the wrong idea from the rumors. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, but unfortunately, a lot of these guys didn't listen, and they went out, and the web is full of life on Mars. I wish there was as much life on Mars as there is articles about life on Mars. So, interesting findings. There's organic chemistry. There's kind of organic chemistry in a lot of places. That's the wonderful nature of organic chemistry. If you give it the slightest chance, carbon will combine with a whole bunch of very interesting things and do a whole bunch of interesting things with it. So, hope for the best, but I'm not a big optimist about finding little green men. But you never know. Okay, moving on. There was a recent new technique used to find heavy neutron stars, and they found one that was 2.3 solar masses. And this is not the heaviest neutron star measured. That honor goes to one that's 2.4 solar masses. And when you keep in mind that recently they figured out that the remnants of those two neutron stars that collided last summer and were found on the gravity wave detector was only 2.7 solar masses, there's really not that much weight difference between a neutron and a black hole. If you were listening last week, you heard how, unfortunately, you can't just add, say, 3/10 of a solar mass to a neutron star and you get yourself a nice, fat, little black hole. You end up getting a very big explosion. Most likely, you don't get a black hole. But, you know, it's sort of interesting to find the borders of both of those. We're kind of fine-tuning our understanding about how big a neutron star could be and how small a black hole could be. And so the search will continue. Mm-hmm. We have KC2SHO from Alamos, Los Alamos out there, and I thought I would throw in a Los Alamos news item. Those smart guys have been playing around with neutrinos. I don't know if you people know that much about neutrinos. They're rather fascinating objects. They have a whole long history. They figured out that there had to be something like a neutrino many, many years ago, but they didn't really know that much about it. They assumed that it didn't have a charge. They assumed it didn't have any mass. Neutrinos interact very weakly with gravity and with something called the weak nuclear force. Very important. No weak nuclear force, no beta decay, no beta decay, no sun fusion, no sun fusion, no life. So neutrinos are important. Let me drop. Now, neutrinos apparently come in three flavors. They're closely related. They're called leptons. The way things work, from last week I mentioned, there are energy carriers called bosons, which have a full integer spin. Those are photons, gravitons, W and Z bosons, and the Higgs boson. Then there's fermions, which are quarks and neutrons and protons and electrons and positrons and what have you. Among splitting those in two, you have hadrons, which are the quark-containing ones, which have an interaction with the strong nuclear force. And those are protons, neutrons, muons, and such, and quarks. And then you have these wonderful things called leptons, which do not feel the strong force. There are charged leptons, like the electron. There are uncharged leptons, which we call the neutrino. So, since there are three charged leptons, the electron, the tau, and the muon, we thought that we had found three different neutrinos, the electron neutrino, the tau neutrino, and the muon neutrino. Let me drop. Now, they found something somewhat fascinating. They set up a very expensive, very big experimental test to count the amount of solar neutrinos coming off the sun, because there's a lot of them. Now, keep in mind that neutrinos are going right through your body as we talk. Billions of neutrinos are penetrating every cell of your body every minute. That's a lot of neutrinos. But fortunately for us, we don't interact much with neutrinos, so they go right past us. But they were doing this wonderful test to see how many electron neutrinos, which is what the sun produces when it fuses hydrogen, and they couldn't find enough neutrinos. They kept on doing the math and doing the math, and it only came up with about one-third of the neutrinos that they should be finding. Let me drop. Well, they're very smart guys, so they got together and they tried to figure out exactly what was happening. And they figured out on a theoretical basis and soon after on an experimental basis that those darn neutrinos were actually oscillating through all three different flavors. It would leave the sun as a electron neutrino, then it would become a muon neutrino, then it would become a tau neutrino, and then it would go back to being an electron neutrino. The reason why they only found one-third of the amount of neutrinos that they were supposed to is because they hadn't bothered to set up the detector to test for the other two types of neutrinos because those weren't produced by the sun. So we now know that neutrinos can oscillate between the three, and they figured out that the only way that's possible is if all three of them have some mass that's different slightly from each other. The fact that they have to have a different mass means that they have to have a mass, because you can't have no mass and a difference simultaneously. So they figured out that neutrinos have a very small mass. Now, I'm talking very small. I'm talking 1/1,000,000th the mass of an electron, and that's small. Let me drop. The guys at Los Alamos wouldn't quit at that. They're around some more with neutrinos, and now they think that they have found something that's going to change the standard model once again. They've had to change it a bunch of times when they decided that neutrinos had mass, because the old standard model didn't have that. They think they found something called a sterile neutrino. A sterile neutrino is a neutrino that, unlike an electron or a tau or muon neutrino, does not interact with the weak nuclear force. It purely operates weakly through gravity and nothing else. And the way that they've considered it is the numbers, once again, don't add up. They were smart enough to build detectors for all three of the neutrinos that they expected, but the count's wrong again. So they're thinking it might be a sterile neutrino. And if it's a sterile neutrino, again, that changes the standard theory, which excites a lot of physicists because they have to rewrite a bunch of textbooks and then charge people to buy them. And also, it gives people more suggestions of what possibly, God forbid, dark matter is. Because they're looking for things that don't quite interact, but interact with gravity and not much of else. And sterile neutrinos are very similar to that description. So you never know. Of course, being scientists, there's arguments about it one way or the other. Interesting finding, and it's nice that Los Alamos is still looking for stuff. Let me drop. Okay. Another thing in the news that's not terribly exciting, but I thought it might amuse a few people, is that scientists have discussed a device that they've decided to call, unfortunately, a flux capacitor device. And immediately caused a lot of web sites to post stuff about it, because if you're a fan of Back to the Future, that was the little gizmo that allowed the characters to go back and forth through time. Unfortunately, the flux capacitor device is not a time device, but a microwave circulator. It goes in one direction. Dick can tell you all about how circulators only allow RF to go in one direction. Okay, moving on. They came up with this new metamaterial that they're very proud of. It has some interesting qualities that they think they're going to be able to use for a whole bunch of useful things. It is transparent to regular visible light, but it absorbs and re-emits infrared, and they're going to be a great passive thermal radiator to dissipate heat at a slightly better percentage than any other passive device. So, yay, materials. They're doing funny things with that stuff. Let me break this up with a little puzzle type of thing. Just to kind of scratch your heads and think about it for a sec. Let's say we take this lovely Earth of ours and we shrink it down to a 1 foot diameter, so it's about the same size as when you guys were in school. There was usually a nice globe sitting on the teacher's desk. So the Earth is now shrunk down to a 1 foot diameter. What do you think, how much water could I get out of all the oceans and all the rivers of the Earth if I got every last drop of water out of that shrunken Earth? How do you think it would fill up? Would it fill up a pint? Would it fill up a cup? Would it fill up a teaspoon? What do you guys think it would fill up?
DXM. WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I would go with a cup. You know, it's I have a globe here, and it's just a couple of feet down, mostly, probably, until you get to the deep parts of the ocean. That would probably add up. So I'm going to go with a cup.
Very good. Keep in mind that 70% of the Earth is covered in water. Anyone else have any suggestions?
GXM.
GXM.
You're Roy Rich here. I would say 1 teaspoon. WB2GXM.
Okay, we have one cup and one teaspoon. Anyone with any other volumes that they think might be the amount of scaled fluid after you shrink the Earth down to a one-foot diameter globe? NBB.
I go with closer to the one teaspoon. It's a very small amount.
Okay, so I have two for one teaspoon and one for one cup. Anyone want to offer any other volume of choice? You really want to pick 1 gallon? Okay, anyone with any other suggestions or volumes before we do the great reveal?
Could I give the volume of water in cubic feet?
Yes, you could if you want. We could always convert.
Well, if it's 1 foot in diameter, that would give a volume of 1/6 pi d³. I'm going to say maybe about 1/5 of a cubic foot of water. About 1/5 of a cubic foot of water.
Okay. I mean, offhand in my brain, I think it's something vaguely like a pint. Is it? Would that be approximately what we're talking about?
Hey, yeah, I guess that would be close enough. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, so we have a pint, we have a cup, and we have two separate suggestions for a teaspoon. Any other volume?
Well, since we're out there and numbers out there, I might as well throw mine in. How about an ounce? 1 ounce, KC2SHO.
Okay, very good. So we now have a pint, we have a cup. We have an ounce, and we have a teaspoon. Any other measurements?
How about a quart?
Okay, how about a quart? Okay, I mean, the obvious point this exercise attempts to make is the fact that when you scale things down, we're not really... We don't have a good sense of proportions in our mind. We tend to think that the atmosphere is very thick when it's a fine line that just covers us just barely enough. And although 70% of the surface of the Earth is covered in water, it's not covered by a heck of a lot of water. And there's a heck of a lot of Earth below that water. So if you do the math about how much volume of water there is in this world and scale it down to the size of a sphere that's 1 foot, you basically get 15 cc's of fluid for a level tablespoon. So it's a little bit more than the teaspoon. Teaspoons are approximately 5 cc's, so it's 3 teaspoons or 1 tablespoon is the answer. But, I mean, that strikes me as incredibly absurd, because I, too, think that the seas are deep things, when they're really not.
Maybe a good way to look at it is if you have one of those globes that is a relief globe, the mountains don't stick up very high.
Well, yes, that's true. But it somewhat depends upon the manufacturer. A lot of times they exaggerate the heights of topological structures because if they didn't, people would be unhappy with the incredible lack of height of large mountain ranges on the Earth.
Have you been watching that show, One Strange Rock? This conversation makes me think of that show. KC2SHO.
No, I haven't. Is that a documentary? Is that a drama? I'm unfamiliar with that one.
A new documentary on the Nat Geo channel, I believe. And Will Smith is the host. So maybe not the best host in my opinion, but hopefully it will bring some of this type of information to the masses with a more familiar face. And they interview a lot of the astronauts, and your comment on the thinness of the atmosphere is really drilled into your head in that show. Worth watching. I forget how many episodes there are, or if I've even seen them all, but pretty good show and some new information that I didn't realize had come from observations made from the space station. Back to you, KC2SHO.
Okay, very good. I'll have to check on that. I never heard of it, but I'm sure there's lots of documentaries that I haven't gotten around to find much. You work at Los Alamos. I assume it's very kind of a localized type of a thing where everyone doesn't kind of share what they're researching and what paper they're released. So I would be curious about whether the sterile neutrinos made it into the general conversation there.
KD2GRS.
I'm sure that there are conversations here. You know, the lab employees almost, I forget which way the number goes.
KD2GRS.
1,000 in the town and 10,000 in the lab, or 12,000 in the lab and 10,000 in the town, something like that. But it's in flux because of all the hiring going on. But it's quite a large place, and I'm a bit separated from a lot of that in many ways. It would be interesting to know, for sure.
Yeah, I get the sense that, like most professional organizations, there are these little cliques of subspecialties where they talk a lot to each other, but not a heck of a lot to other groups. The KD2GRS wanted to say something?
I'm sorry, this is completely off topic. I was wondering what the name of this net was, and do you meet regularly?
Yes, this is the Limark Technical Net. It's been going on for 35 years, long before I got my license. Dick, A2RIW, is the master of ceremonies. It begins at 8 o'clock and goes on until 12 o'clock when they turn the repeater off.
Oh, okay, roger that. I've heard of that net. I just picked it up on a weird frequency up on 70 centimeters. That's why I was curious. I don't even have an offset programmed into the repeater here. It's up on 431.150.
Okay, that's curious. Maybe someone's echoing it. I know HWW occasionally used to echo transmissions of technical nets that he heard.
One of my link frequencies. By the way, I think I know what's going on with the audio.
Feel free to share.
All right, I've been watching the limiter of the repeater. The signal strength is really strong, but every time that event happens, there's a little dip. It's not much, but it's enough to cause the voter to say, "Ah, that's noise." Now, I don't know whether it's an impulse noise or maybe it's just multipath. It only happens occasionally. And when that happens, it switches over to a different receiver input. And that's kind of why I think we're hearing what we're hearing.
KD2GRS.
GRS.
Okay, I'm going to listen to the rest of that. It's a fascinating conversation. I was just curious about this, so sorry for the interruption. Standing by.
No problem, KDGRS. So, Eric, is there any solution that I could do something other than use another radio, which I'd rather not?
Oh, well, after looking at it, I don't think it's your radio. I don't know if you can move your antenna one way or the other. But I could, in fact, turn the other receivers off, and we'll see what happens. Although I do see it as a slight dip, maybe a 2 or 3 dB dip in signal strength, just for a very tiny fraction of time. But it's enough for the voter to sense, oh, that's noise, I'll switch over to another one.
Okay, if you could tweak something on the repeater, I would be very grateful. I don't think it's quite location of the antenna, because when this primary antenna went down, I switched to my backup antenna, which is about 35 feet away from the first one, and that was when we first picked up this anomaly. So, within short distances of my residence, I think moving the antenna is not going to do much.
No, quite frankly, I wouldn't bet on that. You'd be surprised. Anyway, next TechNet, I will change the parameters, which will make it rather difficult because some of the other folks wind up going into the other inputs. So what might have been a strong signal might be a weak signal. So, but next week we'll do something, and we'll see what happens.
Okay, very good. Let's go back to good old buoyancy. It was so much fun the last few times that we did it. You have a fresh egg, you have a stale old egg. You put it in a big tank of water. One floats, the other sinks. Without using your nose to tell which is the old one, any thoughts of which one is which?
WB2GXM.
GXM.
Roy, I do believe that the fresh egg will sink. That's what I think I remember. Rich, WB2GXM.
Good. Anyone else with any thoughts on the subject?
A VDH with a comment?
Yes, VDH.
Yeah, I think the gases generated as the egg goes bad cause it to float. So I think also I'll agree that the fresh egg would sink, and the bad egg, as it were, would float. Go ahead.
Okay, so we have two for the good egg sinking and the bad egg floating. Anyone want to take the opposite position just as devil's advocate?
A deviled egg?
Say again?
You're saying you want to have a deviled egg in there?
No, I said a devil's advocate. Anyway, both gentlemen were quite correct. As eggs age, the liquids evaporate out of the egg, which is air goes through them. They're vague. They're slightly porous, and so you have a lot of the mass evaporating away from a fresh egg until finally it displaces more weight than it contains, and it becomes buoyant. So if you see any eggs floating on the top of any of your water, you're probably best to throw them out. Well, I pretty much went through most of my stuff tonight, so it's surprising. One week I had basically two lines of text that took us an hour and a half, and this was a lot more than two lines of text. So I think I'm pretty much done for the night, unless anyone wants to either discuss anything that I've spoken about or wants to bring anything else up to conversation. Okay, I guess that's a wrap then. Once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and if you want to ask me any questions or suggest a topic or make any statements of agreeing, disagreeing, what have you. It's mailbag@ac2gs.com. Once again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And as soon, well, probably in about 15, 20 minutes, if you go over to roy.ac2gs.com, you will find a series of website linkages to every subject that I pretty much talked about. So I guess over to you, Dick.
Okay. Did you want to cover that one email topic that went over you with the guy with the fireman catching that guy or no?
Well, we can talk about it. Unfortunately, it's a bit of math, and I get the impression people don't particularly like math. But a gentleman sent me an email that showed me a website from Wired.com about a East European fireman who had grabbed a falling person from the flight above during a fire. And he kind of astounded, as was the writer, the article, that you could actually catch someone in flight free fall. It's sort of possible. I wouldn't recommend it to either the person falling or the person catching them, but it is possible. Let me drop. If you start doing searches for it in YouTube and such, you tend to see a lot more stories about people catching very, very light, small children, which is a heck of a lot easier. The math involved in the person falling from the store above the fireman probably had to have at least 300 pounds of force to keep them in his hands and then to lift him up because of the mild acceleration due to the free fall from the previous floor. So you'll see a lot of children being caught since they're a lot lighter than adults. And even in that case, there's some reports that are not very nice to look at. There was one report from China of a young woman who fell out of an 11-story building, and some really tried to catch her. She did not make it. Basically, she slightly broke her fall by breaking this poor guy into a bunch of pieces. He survived, but he's going to require a lot of physical therapy. There's one YouTube where a three-year-old was dancing on an air conditioner and jumped off, and the guy was able to catch her early enough that no one was injured. So that's pretty much the story of gravity. When they're dropping from too many flights, it's pretty much a death sentence. No matter what you got down there, even with a trampoline is somewhat problematic. But with a human being just with their arms stretched out, that can be dangerous for both. So, Paul, do you think I pretty much covered that article that Richard sent us?
Yes, it's W2BZ. Listening, he'll be happy that you covered it. Yeah, I know. I saw all the math on that. You know, the idea of the guy falling at 32 feet per second. They use the metric system now in describing that. But this guy coming down with that kind of weight. But they do it in gymnastics. If somebody falls off a high bar, you'll catch somebody. And the guy would only probably be about 8 feet above him, not necessarily 10 feet, because the window wouldn't necessarily be 10 or 12 feet above the guy's head. He's probably a lot closer than that. So, I'm sure it's doable. I don't know if the video was real. It looked real. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it looked real to me, and I was pleased that the article didn't overdo it. They didn't really suggest that it was from a 6 meter difference. I think they finally settled on something like a 3 meter difference, because the reality is very likely that the person was holding on to the ledge of the window above. So probably his feet or her feet were only, inches to a foot above the top of the window that we were looking through. So when he or she started to free fall, it probably wasn't that far before the guy, the fireman, was able to grab. Still a heroic thing, and probably I wouldn't have been able to hold on to him or her, but that's what firemen do for a living, and it's a good thing that we have them doing that.
Okay, Roy, very good. Do you want me to take it from here?
Yeah, I guess I've pretty much done what I came to do. There's no other further questions, so take it away, Space Report.
Thanks, Roy, and this is WS2N Paul for the SpaceNet Report on the TechNet, and you covered the Jupiter Lightning, and I think you were wondering about the spacecraft, how, you know, when it was launched, and that's the Juno spacecraft, launched back in 2011, and then it went into orbit, probably 2015, so it's been in orbit a year or two, and it's been doing so good that they just gave it a 3-year extension. NASA got an approval for that. So it's in a polar orbit around Jupiter. It's got a 53-day orbit. Every 53 days it goes all the way around Jupiter. So it goes out about 9 times the diameter of Jupiter and comes back down very close to the clouds. And at some point, or actually many points, it's taken pictures of the lightning. It has a camera and all kinds of equipment, radio detecting equipment. Apparently, they must have confirmed what you said. I didn't read the article, but that the lightning is very similar to what we have here on Earth. There's a lot more of it and much more intense. But I think it's being created by a lot of the clouds that are hitting one another violently on the surface. Although I haven't read that. So, I was going to start talking about the launch of a Soyuz spacecraft that went up June 6th, last Wednesday, with 3 people. It has the commander from Roscosmos, Sergei Prokopyev, he's got to be able to fly that thing. And then you have 2 people, one from the European Space Agency, Alexander Gerst, and then you have Dr. Serena Anon, is her name. She's KG5 TMT. Also, Alex also has a call letter, but Serena is she's been working for this for many years and got her shot, so she'll be up with the other 2 for about 6 months on board the space station under the Expedition 56 name. And 56, that means there's been 56 expeditions to the space station since its beginning. They started manning that thing around 2000. So the last 18 years. So before they went up, 3 days before, you had 3 people come back down. So you know, temporarily you had three people on the space station. Now you're back up to its normal 6. This Thursday they're going to have an EVA around 8:30 at night. Eastern Standard Time, I think it's about 6:30. 6:30 a.m., I believe it was. I'll have to double-check. But they have an EVA. 2 Americans, Ricky Arnold and Drew Feisel, will be going out. The Quest airlock to do an EVA to relocate and to do a lot of camera work that has to be relocated. There's many EVAs dedicated to the upcoming manned flights of Boeing and SpaceX from American soil. And a lot of time has been
getting ready for that, was installing the ITER system. The ITER is the International Docking Adapter, which connects to one of the PMA pressure mating adapters. Pressure mating adapters, what the shuttle used to connect to, and then they would, you know, enter the space station in that, you know, through the PMA. But because the shuttle is gone and they've, you know, the time has evolved, they've come up with a better docking adapter. Rather than changing out this whole big pressure mating adapter, PMA, there's three on board the International Space Station, PMA 1, 2, and 3. Rather than change out that, they just built a new international docking adapter to bolt to the end of the PMA. And with that, they've got one installed, and there's another one yet to be installed, because there's going to be two locations where spacecraft can dock with people in it. Right now, when the cargo versions go up, either by Japan or by SpaceX, or by Orbital ATK with the Cygnus spacecraft, those cargo modules, they don't really dock to the space station. They're berths. They call them berths. When they get close to the space station, finally they get around 30 feet away, some crew member of the space station reaches out with the 57-foot robotic arm, Canadian robot arm 2, and grapples it, and they attach it to the to one of the nodes, one of the locations on the space station, and then they have these 16 bolts, and they electronically drive them, and eventually they can open a hatch and bring in all the cargo and everything. That's not good enough for crewed missions. You need to be able to dock, not berth, but dock. They come up with, and they have this system that they have a soft dock, and then they pull themselves in, and they don't have all these bolts that they have to make up to connect to the space station. And then they're able to enter the space station, and they'll also have automatic connections between the vehicle that they come up in and the solar panels, and in some cases fuel will also be able to be transferred. But to do that, they need to have all these different wiring and data and power, and now cameras to facilitate that those up and coming missions. You also need a quick escape. If there's an emergency on board the space station, everybody runs to their spaceship. These spaceships that go up will stay docked to the space station for, say, 6 months. The ones they come up in are really their lifeboat. So you always have to have a seat. So if there's three people on a space station, you need at least one spacecraft that can carry three people. New spacecraft are going to be able to carry four up, so at some point you might have seven people permanently put on a space station, and you're going to need seats for everybody. So you have to be able to get into your spaceship quickly and then immediately disconnect. You don't have time to unbolt all these 16 bolts that go on with the berthing system that takes sometimes many hours to disconnect and have one fly away from the space station. With the automatic docking system, you could do it almost right away, probably within 15 minutes. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. Okay, so that's the story on that. The race to space with people, though, is I think it might be delayed a little bit. SpaceX has got to be able to fly their boosters, their new boosters, at least 7 times before you can fly people on it. In fact, they had a plan many years ago, probably about 3 years ago, to send 2 people around the moon in a Dragon spacecraft. This is by SpaceX. But let me change my power out. The power's too high here. Stand by. See that, Roy? We all have radio issues to deal with. Mine's power. I can't run it too hot for too long, otherwise the radio will tell me that. The idea of putting 2 people around the moon isn't going to happen anytime soon. They'll have NASA flights and all before that ever happens. So I'm predicting maybe another 3 years before these 2 people who spoke to Elon Musk of SpaceX and wanted to go for a ride around the moon, I think they're going to have to wait. Let me drop it. I just want to give you an update on the InSight mission that's going to Mars. We covered that here on the net. That launched a while back, and eventually we'll be landing on Mars. Not a rover, but we'll be landing on Mars. That's the one that's going to do seismic activity. It's going to drill 3 meters into the Martian ground and do all that type of work. That won't happen until the day after Thanksgiving this year, when it does land on November 26th. But the 2 spacecraft that are following it, that are going to be picking up the signals and sending them real time back to Earth, are called Marco 1 and Marco 2, actually Marco A and B. And they were attached to the same booster that InSight was. So when that booster separated InSight, shortly after that, the booster also released the 2 CubeSats, which are now following InSight all the way to Mars. There's some course corrections that have to be done. InSight already did one. They'll probably do a couple more before they get close to Mars. But so do these 2 Marco CubeSats that are following InSight. A and B have their own thrusters on board, and A was successfully done, and then B, they knew from the telemetry that's coming back, they're reading the metadata, and it said that apparently B has a slight leak, so it's throwing the spacecraft a little bit off, but it's very slight, and they think they could deal with it. So it did make a course correction, and it's presently on the way to Mars. But as long as the leak doesn't get any worse, and they're able to make their 2 or 3 other course corrections over the next couple of months, that should all work out. Marco A and Marco B should be able to send signals back to Earth successfully and right after Thanksgiving. This is WS2M. Also last week, June 4th, SpaceX launched a very heavy telecommunications satellite to geosynchronous orbit. I think the thing was almost 13,000 pounds, and they launched it. It's going to be permanently stationed over the Pacific for the Asian area. So that successfully went up. They did not recover the booster on purpose because that booster was already launched before. So they're still making their flights. There's going to be probably at least maybe 10 or 12 more flights this year for a total of, I believe, 28, which will be the most for SpaceX any year. The only thing is, next year they think they're going to be cutting back about, I read, 40%. Less flights. There is not as much of a demand for these geosynchronous satellites that are being sent up. So we'll see what happens with that. That's why it might take some time for SpaceX to qualify these boosters, these Block 5 boosters. That's their last Falcon 9 version or iteration of the Falcon 9 rocket. And they need to fly that new version seven times, if not at once, seven times for NASA to say, okay, we're going to put people on top of this thing. I'm going to guess first time we'll see people probably maybe early 2019, next year. I just want to talk about Curiosity riding around on Mars. I know we talked about it a little bit with Roy. The topic that they talked about with possible life on Mars, those tests weren't done just like yesterday. They were done back in 2012 when this thing first landed on Mars. It first landed on Mars in 2012. Here we are 6 years later, and it's still doing work, riding around a Gale crater. Doing science. So what happened was in the last year and a half, this drill that they used to test back in 2012 stopped functioning. The way it works, it has this big robotic arm and it goes down near a rock, and it's got this drill bit that's set in this gearing motion, and you know, it'll come close to that rock, and then the drill will actually be fed out from this mechanism and go into, you know, drill into the rock, and then it would retreat and eventually take the sample and put it into the SAM, or the sample analyzer on Mars machine inside the body of the Curiosity. That's the way it's supposed to work. And that's the way it was working for the first couple of years. But a year and a half ago, that motor that extended the drill bit stopped functioning. So they've been testing the other rover. We have a rover at Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, an exact duplicate of what's riding around on Mars, looking for new ways to be able to drill. Well, you know, the idea is to be able to drill straight in and not get jammed up where you can't get the drill bit out, and then, you know, you're out of luck. Stuck there forever. So they've been working for a year and a half. They found another way to do it instead of just extending the drill, because that motor is now not functioning. They have the drill all the way out, permanently out, without retracting. And then they'll come up to a rock and they'll actually push the drill bit into the rock by using pressure of the arm itself. They'll be able to move the motors in a certain way out with the arm itself to push into the rock. So apparently that worked out. And now they are back in operation. As of a week or two ago, they went over to another rock and they tested this whole thing out, and it worked. They were able to get the sample up, and the amount is so small, it's less than a half of a baby aspirin. You know, if you know how big that is, it's very tiny. And that's the amount of material that they get, and the arm is able to put it into the top deck of the SAM analyzing machine on, you know, inside the body of the Curiosity to run these tests. So, with that completed, they're going to be back in operation for as long as this rover keeps running. It's not powered by solar panels, so we don't have to worry about that. It's just powered by nuclear power. It's got this RTG radioisotope thermal electric generator that drives that thing from day to day, year to year. One of the discoveries that they did make, going back to what Roy was talking about, was this methane thing. They were able to drill into these rocks about 4 years ago. And it took all this time for the scientists to figure it out, but they finally figured out that this methane that's being released, that they were tested in many different places.